What may be the most remembered moment in the history of the New York Mets occurred during Game 6 of the 1986 World Series when Mookie Wilson hit a slow roller that went through the legs of Boston first baseman Bill Buckner. It won the game and allowed the Mets to go on to win the series. Now, Mookie has written a memoir of his life in baseball leading up to that point and also about what he's done since. Mookie, Life, Baseball, and the 86 Mets is published by Berkeley, and I'm very pleased to welcome Mookie Wilson back to our show. Hi.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
The first chapter of the book is devoted to that bottom half of the 10th inning in that game, including all 10 pitches of your historic at-bat. Now, I remember when Keith Hernandez was once on the show, and he talked about some at-bat he had, and he remembered every pitch, low outside curve, et cetera. Do you remember that way, or did you have to go back and look at the video?
I really had to go back and look at the video because I'm one of those guys that live in the moment, and I was only concerned about the results. I remember a couple of the foul balls. But I honestly, looking back at it, I don't remember half of those pitches.
And what's going through your mind? You say that that every player goes up in a situation like that and says, I'm not going to make the last out.
Yeah, well, that's where I was. I mean, first of all, I didn't think I could get an opportunity. But then after everything kind of progressed and I had an opportunity to get there and seeing what the other guys had gone through with two strikes in the way they battled, there's no way I could have. I just couldn't see myself being last out. And I was determined not to do that.
And you also were determined, if you were going to strike out swinging. I mean, Carlos Beltran, to some degree, has become a notorious figure in Mets history because he watched a third strike.
Yes. Well, one of my—
Doing okay for the Yankees.
Yeah,
right
one now. Of my theories was, don't let the umpire decide your fate. And I just believe in that. You know, even if it's a little bit out of the strike zone, if I can get the bat on it, that's better than waiting for an umpire to make a bad call, and then that really makes you feel bad.
So just stick the bat out, let it hit a foul ball, and wait for a better pitch.
Man, thou shalt not pass without an offering. That's my theory.
Do you see that as the most important at-bat in your baseball career?
It's by far it's been my best at-bat ever. Two reasons. Number one is I can't think of any other time I've seen 10 pitches.
Because you were not the most patient hitter in the world.
I was not the most patient hitter in the world. And secondly, it proved the one thing that every little league coach preaches, and that is always run. And it all worked out for me.
So it doesn't bother you that despite your incredible popularity when you were a player, this one play defines you for many fans?
It did. I have to be honest. It did, because I would like to think that I've contribute more to the game than just one at bat. But, it's reality now. And reality is that is probably the most memorable thing that I've ever done, in baseball. And I just have to accept it for what it is. I'm part of baseball history, and no one can complain about that.
You write that you think you would have made it to first base even if Bill Buckner had fielded the ball cleanly. You were a very fast runner. Have you been saying that all along, and are there others who agree with you?
I've been saying it all along. There's others who have agreed, except Boston fans. They don't.
What about Bill Buckner? You got to know him.
Yeah, Bill and I, we've actually spoke about this. We talked about it and discussed it. And we come to it was a very, very difficult play for him. He admits that. And he looked up and he thought, that the pitcher was not going to be able to cover. And I thought the same thing. I thought Bill and I was going to be a foot race. And given his condition of his ankle and the position that we was playing, that the odds are definitely in my favor.
And I'm sure he was very aware of the fact that you were fast. And so when people try to rush things, they often mess it up. So do you think he's gotten a bum rap after all, over all these years?
Yeah, well, I've always thought that. I always felt that a lot of things happened before that ball was even hit to Bill Buckner, and a lot of things that the Red Sox did not do enabled us to get back into that ball game. So, yes, I think he's got a bum rap over the years.
The book goes back to show how you got to that point.
Yeah.
You start with your early life in Earhart?
Earhart, yes.
South Carolina. You grew up on a farm?
Yes, I did.
And I was surprised that you write that your father was a sharecropper.
Yes.
Who supported the family of 14 on $25 a week.
Yes.
I thought sharecropping ended somewhere in the 30s.
No. But it was very much alive.
It was the 50s and 60s.
It was very much alive. And I had the pleasure of experiencing farming in under those conditions. It gave me a sense of appreciation for everything.
In what way? Because you understood how nature works?
That's for one. I understand how nature works. I understand how to survive. you know, you have to find a way to survive with little, you know. In
you
this
didn't
country.
Have running water in your house.
Not in the house. No, we did not have running water in the house. It was installed a little bit later, but we didn't have running water actually in the house, indoor toilets and stuff, until I actually moved closer to town limits when my father moved into a subsidized house.
Yeah, but you still learned to play baseball.
Yes.
Was that something that all the kids in the town did?
Baseball was something that was mandatory in my family. I mean, that was our recreation on the weekends. We work hard during the week, and Saturdays and Sundays was recreation. We worked Saturday mornings, but baseball was Saturday either, and nothing got in the way of baseball. And my father was an avid baseball fan.
And did people recognize that perhaps you had the kinds of ability, skill, talent to go further than the other kids in your town?
I don't think that was anything that people really looked for. I think that they recognized that we were good ball players, but I think that no one really expected it to go this far. I mean, you know, we were known for being good ball players, all of us. I mean, and so that was expected of us to do those things, but not to go to the level that I've made it to.
Well, one person who really took you under his wing was, when you were a teenager, yeah, a kind of a mentor, was Judge Julius Ness.
Yes.
Who was he, and what did he do to help you become a skilled player?
Judge Julius B. Ness is probably one of the most caring men that I've met. He was a judge in the Bamberg County. He later became South Carolina Supreme Court judge. And he actually made it possible for me to play American Legion ball, provided me with transportation to go back and forth, which is about 30 miles from my home, you know, to play American Legion baseball. And when I got
there, they would drive you to the game.
He would actually drive me to the game and have me make sure I had transportation to do so. After the American Legion ball, he actually drove me to Spartanbury Methodist Junior College to enroll in college. And
why do you think he was so generous?
I don't know. Maybe he was just a good person.
But he must have seen something in you.
He must have seen something in me that no one else. Maybe I didn't even see in myself. But it's because of him that I actually ended up in college. And it's because of my father. I had the good sense to appreciate when someone was giving me a helping hand.
My guest is Mookie Wilson. He's written a memoir called, with the help of Eric Sherman. Yeah. It has a foreword by Keith Hernandez. It's called Mookie, Life, Baseball, and the 86 Mets. It's published by Berkeley. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So you were drafted by the Mets while you were at the University of South Carolina. You'd gone from junior college to the University of South Carolina. Yeah. Had you been a star on that team?
Yes. I actually, the University of South Carolina, we went to the College World Series, in the spring of 1977. I was definitely a star. I won't say I was one of the best player on the team, but I was one of the top three players on the team.
Did others make it to the majors?
Oh, yes. We had a pitcher that was drafted number one overall, which was Randy Marts. Mm-hmm. He played for the Cubs. And we had Ed Lynch, who also played in the big leagues, actually played with the Mets. Yes. He plays on the 86 team. And some other guys like Mark Bambera, who also played with Baltimore. I don't know if he made it to the big leagues. I don't think he did. You had had David Smalls, you know, Jim Lewis. Those guys, it was a very good baseball team.
Your father wanted you to stay and finish school.
Yes.
But you left before you graduated.
Yes.
Were you happy about going to New York and the Mets? Some ball players, especially from small towns, the idea of coming to New York is not all that – doesn't make them all that happy.
It was scary. When I was first drafted, playing in New York was not a thought. You know, I was just kind of excited about going to the next level. The thought of playing New York didn't hit me until maybe later I got in AAA and listened to some of the players who had played in New York. Before that, I had no fear. But once I got here, reality kind of set in. It wasn't as easy as I thought it would be. It was an adjustment for me to make. Culture shock, by the way. I'm from South Carolina. Population of about 500 in my hometown. Now, all of a sudden, we have more people in the ballpark than I had in my hometown. So, yes, it's a little fear there, but I'm okay.
And then you adjusted. You learned how to live in the big city. But how long did you spend in the minors?
I spent 3.5 years, you know, in the minors. I signed in 77, and I came up to New York in the September of 1980.
First, you were in Wausau, Wisconsin.
Wausau, Wisconsin.
Then Jackson.
Then Jackson.
And then Tidewater.
Then Tidewater.
Tidewater was the AAA team
at the
time.
That was the AAA team, yes.
And then you came up to the Major League team in 1980.
Yes.
That was not a very good team at that time, was it?
You being kind. It was a terrible team. It really was. The players were good people. There's no question about it. But we just could not compete with the other clubs, and it was very depressing.
But do you think that was good for you in a way, because you would get more playing time?
Oh, it was definitely good for me. It enabled me to an opportunity to come right in and start playing. I didn't have to sit and wait for someone to get injured or anything of that nature. But that doesn't change the fact that it was a terrible ball club. And I felt bad because, I really thought that I was going to make a big difference right away. And I didn't, sometimes that can kind of put a damper on your ego.
And being on a losing team, and the team was a losing team for a number of years. The Mets were in last place as late as 1983.
Yeah.
So you'd been with them for 3 years at that point. That has to get you down.
Well, the first 2 years, it really was. And sometimes, you often thought that maybe you made a mistake. But then in 83, you start to see changes. We were still losing, but we were competitive. We were actually in ball games, and that made things a lot better.
And then I would say the general manager, Frank Cashin, played a major role in turning that around. He acquired Keith Hernandez from the Cardinals, Gary Carter from the Expos, and then there were all of these other people who were coming up on the team, Daryl Strawberry, Dwight Gooden.
Yes.
Suddenly you had the equivalent of an all-star team.
Yeah, well, the good thing about that is when I came up in 81, which was my rookie year, I had other guys with me like Hubie Brooks and Wally Beck, those guys, and we were in it together. So that made it really, really easy. But we still needed some veteran leadership, and that's where Keith Hernandez came in, and that's where Gary Carter came in. And later on, after Keith Hernandez, they brought in guys like George Foster, to help out, and Rusty Staub came back to kind of help us along. So we were – he had a plan. It definitely worked out.
And then your manager was Davey Johnson, who's generally been a winning manager. How important is a manager for a team's success?
I've been asked that question less than 2 days ago, and managers have a really, really big role. There's an old saying that, the number can fluctuate either up or down, but a manager really is only going to affect maybe 10 to 20 ball games a year out of 162 that he actually have a hand in winning or losing.
Well, 10 or 20, it can be
that could be the
difference between coming in first place.
It could
or
be
not.
The difference to making it. And so, that a manager's job is to organize the players you have, understand the personnel, and communicate with those people. And David was good at that. He understood what ball players he needed to talk to, which ball players need to leave alone, and which ones that he needed to contribute more. David was good at he was a good manager in terms of being hands off, for lack of a better term. They call him a player's manager. Player's manager is simply a guy who understands who he has. That's all.
Well, we have these managers who do incredibly well, and then one day the team. It's doing less well, and they're fired.
Yes.
They didn't make those errors.
Yeah.
They didn't swing at bad pitches.
Yeah.
And then in comes another manager. Does the new manager bring new energy to the team, or much be done?
Well, what happens a lot of times is players become complacent, particularly if he has a level of success. And what happens is if the manager gets fired, then it brings reality to the players that, things look different. We better get back on the ball. And it happens a lot, and I think that managers, get far too much credit and far too much blame for when things don't go wrong.
And then Davey Johnson goes on to success with other teams.
Yes.
And then he gets fired again.
That's a cycle of baseball.
My guest is Mookie Wilson, who with Eric Sherman has written a memoir called Mookie, Life, Baseball, and the 86 Mets. It is published by Berkeley. And we will come back and talk about the team that suddenly put it all together in 1986 after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Mookie Wilson, who has written with the help of Eric Sherman a memoir called Mookie, Life, Baseball, and the 86 Mets. It's published by Berkeley. Did you feel at the beginning of the 86 season that this was your year?
Yes. No question about it. We had a terrific team that was spilling over from the 85 season. We were very, very confident of what our capabilities were.
Well, it was smooth sailing until you got to the playoff series with the Astros. Interestingly, the Astros were the other team that was formed when the Mets were formed.
Yeah.
And they've never won a World Series, have they?
No, I don't think they have won a World Series. And it's interesting because that was the one team that we felt did match up with us very well. They had the pitching. They had speed. They had a fair amount of power. So they really did match up with us very well, as the series kind of showed.
And the sixth game of that series was kind of iconic. You call it the greatest game ever played?
Yeah, the greatest game I ever been in. I mean, it was a phenomenal game. I'm surprised I didn't have a heart attack that game.
It went 16 innings.
Oh, it was just the ups and the downs and the disappointments. It was just one of those games where you just say, will someone win it, please, so we can start tomorrow? It was that kind of game.
Every time a team would pull ahead, the other team would tie
it
up.
It was a phenomenal.
But what do you feel like when you're in the 15th and 16th inning? You must be exhausted.
Believe me, we were
emotionally and physically.
Emotionally is where we are drained. Physically, you can kind of deal with that because you can always drink a Coca-Cola or something like that to get a little energy going on. But emotionally, there was just nothing left, and we had more on the line than I think that. The Astros had, we were going to face Mike Scott the next game if we don't pull something out there. And we know what all Mike Scott has done to us over that year. So,
well, he had been a pitcher with the Mets, and the Mets let him go.
Yes.
And, of course, there were rumors that he threw a spitball. Do you think he did?
There were rumors that he did something with the baseball, but we're not going to talk about that today. But we knew we didn't want to face Mike Scott in Game 7.
So you had these two amazing games. You had that game, and then in this World Series, you had the game that where you got that winning hit.
Yeah.
Was the team unified? I mean, there were a wide range of personalities on that team.
Believe it or not, as diverse as that team was, there was a unity that was unmatched in any team I've ever been on. I mean, we had guys that was just so different, in personalities that you wouldn't think that they really got along, but they did.
Well,
awesome.
Other teams talked about the Mets being rather arrogant.
Yes.
They didn't like you. But it was also a hard partying bunch.
Yeah.
Did you think that that didn't matter because you won the World Series?
It didn't matter at the time. When you're winning, you tend to not see a lot of things. And as long as things doesn't affect the bottom line, which is winning, you pretty much can tolerate a lot of things.
Well, a team that ranges from straight arrows like you and Gary Carter to somebody who's a total wild man like Lenny Dykstra and a man who's already having problems with drugs like Doc Gooden.
Yeah.
Were you all aware of how different you were?
We were aware how different we were. I don't think we were aware of the drug issues.
You didn't know that Doc Gooden was in serious trouble with drugs?
No, that is something that, as a player, I was very unaware of it. And a lot of the other players were unaware. Matter of fact, we were pretty shocked. But we're aware of some of the guys who maybe go out at night and drink here, there. But guess what? That happens on every team. Every team has those guys that do that.
Well, Doc was here to talk about. He wrote a book recently.
Yes, he did.
And to talk about what happened when he didn't show up for the celebration.
Yeah.
Was that when you started realizing that he had real problems?
I think that's when it hit home. I think that's when we say we had to take a step back and say, okay, what has happened here? And it's not so much, it's more important. It goes farther than just that. We realized that this was a young man who really had given me all the respect in the world. And
He should be in the hall. He should have been in the Hall of Fame didn't mess up.
Oh, with the talent, this kid was envy of all the baseball. Any pitcher in Major League Baseball would be envious of this kid. He had it all. And here he is. he was in a very, very dangerous position right now in his life, not just as a ball player, but as a human being. And we just did not see it coming, and it hurt us.
Well, you're right that the 86 season should have been the start of a dynasty.
Yes.
And then the team fell apart. I mean, you talked about how good the chemistry was. Yeah. What happened?
Well, two things happened. I think that number one thing happened, not necessarily in this order, but one thing happened was I think that we became a victim of our own success. You know, I think we started taking things for granted, which means other teams, and that things are just going to happen. Listen, the sixth game in the 86 World Series don't happen very often, so we couldn't expect that to happen. You know, teams weren't going to lay down. The other thing was that management decided that they were going to move some of the personnel on that team. For whatever reason, they had their own reasons.
You mean to save some money?
I don't know. I can't imagine saving money would have been an issue there then. But we lost personalities. We lost Ray Knight. We lost Kevin Mitchell. We eventually lost Roger McDowell. We eventually, you know, guys that were very, very important to that ball club, not just on the field. Baseball is more than about numbers. It's about character. It's about a cohesiveness of a team, and we had lost that.
All of those players were loved by the fans.
Yes.
Well, I mean, that's teammates. Important, too.
And by their teammates. Their teammate, it actually really was disturbing when we lost Kevin Mitchell. I thought that was our key part of our chemistry, of our identity. And, it just
and he
there.
Did well.
Did well.
After he left.
Yes, he did.
They eventually traded you.
Yes.
How long had you been on the team at that point?
I've been with the team ever since since September of 80. Mm. And my role had been reduced to a part-time player. And now when I was traded, people should understand that even though I was traded, I actually requested a trade long before I was traded because of the lack of playing time. And I felt that I should have been played more on a more regular basis.
So you wound up on the Blue Jays with Bill Buckner.
Well, Bill was with Kansas City, and we ended up playing against each other, and we kind of crossed paths. That's the first time I had seen him since the 86 season.
But then, was it awkward?
It was for me. I wrote in the book how our first encounter was, and Bill was just as gracious as I can't say enough about Bill and how easy it made for me to be able to stand up and speak with him because I felt really bad about the things that had happened to him, and the way it had happened, because I knew him before the season had even started.
Well, you've been paired at autograph signings, what happened to the ball that went through his legs?
The ball was brought to the clubhouse. It was given to me by Arthur Richmond, and I signed the ball and gave it to Arthur, you know, just as a token. I mean, if I had known it was going to be worth $400,000, there's no way.
Recently auctioned for $400,000.
No way I would have given that ball to Arthur. But at the time, it didn't mean anything to me. You know, I was still, you know, we were still on cloud nine for winning, you know. And if I probably had overnight to think about it, I probably would have kept the ball.
Well, you probably had some other balls, like the first home run that you hit, or
I had the first hit, the first home run. Who cares about my first home run? I didn't have enough of them to count, but it's funny.
First of all, have you been in touch with all of these guys over the years?
A lot. Oh, we see each other on a lot, regular basis. You know, at least once a year, we see a lot of the guys.
Among the surprising revelations in this book, you write that after you left baseball, you drove trucks for a living.
Yeah.
Was that an economic necessity? Hadn't you made enough money as a ball player?
Well, first of all, I did not make enough money as a ball player. I missed the big money, you know, the big money era. But
today, if you have a lifetime batting average of .226 and you don't make $20 million, you're a loser.
Yeah, you can do that. But I drove truck because I enjoyed it. It was a hobby, and I drove it part-time. I've always enjoyed driving truck. I still do to this day. It's not an economic move, no, by no stretch of imagination. But it's something I enjoy doing, and in my leisure time, I like driving.
But you also got back into baseball at a certain point as a coach, and then as a minor league manager.
Yes.
You managed the Brooklyn Cyclones for a while.
Kingsport Mets and then Brooklyn Cyclones, yes.
Did you enjoy that as much as you enjoyed truck driving?
I enjoyed managing. I can't say that, you know, I have to say no, I enjoy managing more than truck driving. managing is baseball, and baseball has always been my first love, and I love teaching the game, and managing gave me an opportunity to do that to a limited capacity. It's something that I would have liked to continue doing, but baseball has a funny sense of humor.
Well, after the Mets signed your son,
yes,
did that cause trouble? Because he didn't really make it with the Mets.
No, not at all.
Well, I mean, you're rooting for the team to stick with him.
As a matter of fact, he played his first major league game with the Mets, and he was traded for Mike Piazza. And he had a very, very successful career. I was a little disappointed that I didn't get an opportunity to play with him and coach him at the major league level. But baseball is a game of business, and you have to do what's best for organizations at the time. I didn't like to trade on, and it's personal because I wanted my son in New York.
But Mike Piazza was a pretty good player.
So I can't complain about that. And Preston ended up doing very, very well. So we all worked out well.
You were a first base coach for the Mets in 2011. Now you're a team ambassador.
Yeah.
What does that involve?
It is exactly what the name implies, ambassador. I represent the team. Sponsors. I make visits to the suites. I attend their charity events whenever they call upon me to do so. I must say that I do make one trip to every minor league city once, a year. But that's what I do as a team ambassador.
Well, you write in the book that, and I'm quoting, you've basically become a hood ornament for the Mets, a line that's been widely quoted in
yes.
the press.
Yeah, I think it's a line
that sounds
that's
a
been
little
quoted.
Bitter.
And it sounds bitter, but it really isn't. It's reality. But what I should explain what that means is that, and I use the analogy as the symbol on a car. No matter what symbol you put on a car, you know what that symbol stands for. You can put a Chrysler symbol on a Mercedes, but the symbol says Chrysler. But it has nothing to do with the operation of the car. It's just a symbol. You see the car. When you see Mookie Wilson, you think Mets. But Mookie Wilson has no physical operation of the Mets. So, so I thought that was a very, very good analogy.
Well, there are some players are going into the Hall of Fame.
Yes.
They have to decide what team they want to go in as a member of. In your case, I think pretty much everybody, people say Mets, and they start talking about who were the great players of the past. Your name comes up very soon, if not first.
Well, and that's, I think that proves what I just said, that, I'm a man at heart. I mean, make no mistake, in spite of what people may take away from the book, I'm a man at heart. I love the Mets. I love the city of New York, but it doesn't take away from the truth and what I have felt over the years and what I've gone through.
Well, you're not coaching anymore. They fired you as a coach?
I'm not coaching anymore.
You're not going to say. Did you send somebody home when you shouldn't have?
Maybe I did. I don't. Maybe I got too many people picked off at first base or something. I don't know.
Another surprising revelation is that you've now entered the ministry.
Yes.
Is this something you've been thinking about doing for a long time?
It's something I've always been interested in. In the ministry, I've always been involved in it, and it's not something that I planned over the years. Is something that I think that was always in me, and I think I just finally had the time to devote to it. Sometimes we deny ourselves what God has really said in front of us, and I think sometimes you have to let things go in order to find out who you are.
Although I read an article in which somebody wondered why. When a ball player hits a home run, he kisses up to God. But when he strikes out, he doesn't blame God.
Yeah.
I mean, how much religion can you bring in to being an athlete?
But I think that when being a Christian athlete, you actually have to live in two worlds. You have the world of when you are competitive, and then you have the world of reality where life is still there no matter what you do on a ball field. And I think that ball players, Christian athletes sometimes send a mixed message when they do that. And I think for us to judge them as to what they mean and what's in their heart, it's wrong for us to do. But I understand when people say, well, you only praise God when you hit a home run. What are you going to do when you strike out or get picked off? I don't see you praising God then. Well, if a ball player did that, he would be criticized even more by his peers and by the fans as the a person don't care, which I know Christianity's have a hard time in sports as it is.
Well, if you're really good, you have less of a hard time. Mariano Rivera has also become a minister.
Oh, outstanding.
I mean, he was a pretty good player.
That's not surprising because I've met Mariano and he is one of, just a super, super nice guy.
So why do you think the Mets haven't done all that well since 1986? It's a long time.
It's a lot of things. Anything that I say in terms of what the Mets, why the Mets are where they are right now will be strictly an opinion, you know, of mine. And I, from my opinion, it's just we just don't have the continuity there. And I think once you get that, you know, then things begin to flow. We've had a lot of managers and GMs over the past couple of years. So the Mets are in the process of really developing a corporate structure, a structure where they can be that team. So it takes a little time to do that.
Well, they bring in somebody who's described as a savior, whether it's a young pitcher who can throw the ball 98 miles an hour, or a new manager or a new general manager. And then things don't always work out. And one of the reasons given in recent years is Bernie Madoff. I don't know. Were the ballplayers talking about that?
No, but they don't talk about that because that is something that upper management really had to, you know, deal with because it didn't affect the ballplayers at all. But in terms of bringing players in, you know, one player—
paying salaries.
Yeah, with big salaries. But one player is not going to really turn an organization around unless you have some core players for him to really help, as we did in 86, in 85, and 86. We had the core players, but we needed those one or two players to put us over the hump, which was Keith Hernandez and Gary Carter. So until you get to that point, bringing one player in is really difficult to turn an organization around.
Well, they're doing better than anyone expected so far this season. It's a long season. It might fall apart again, but things may pull together.
It's a long season, but I will tell you this. I love the young ball players that the Mets have. I think that they have an opportunity to really be very, very productive players. It's early, but I have all the confidence in the world in these young players.
On the other hand, it's recently been revealed that the Yankees are a lot more popular in the city, even near City Stadium. Mookie Wilson will be signing books at Bookends in Ridgewood, New Jersey tonight, at Bookmark Shop in Brooklyn tomorrow, and at Book Review in Huntington, New York on Friday. For more information about all those events, go to our show page at WNYC.org. His book, Mookie, Life, Baseball, and the 86 Mets, published by Berkeley. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Man, thanks for having me.